Welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life, produced by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. We've all had those senior moments where we've completely lost our train of thought mid-sentence. Or maybe you've walked into a room only to forget what you went in there to get. It happens to all of us. Perhaps it's just a simple lapse in focus or attention. Or could it be something more serious, like early signs of dementia? Right now, around 55 million people around the world have some form of dementia, and Alzheimer's is the most common cause. As our population ages, Alzheimer's disease is forecasted to become a worldwide epidemic, with nearly 10 million new cases every year. Mainstream medicine would have you believe that it can't be prevented, and that it's untreatable. And until now, most patients with Alzheimer's didn't have any hope.
So when I was training, we never saw people in their 40s and 50s with Alzheimer's. It's one of the most common things we see now. Very, very common. And the biggest increases are in people in their 40s and 50s. So it's no longer old timers disease. You know, it really is a disease that we get in our 20s, 30s, and 40s that's diagnosed 20 years later. And in fact, I've had a couple of calls from people who were told nothing could be done at various university centers of excellence, and then went on the protocol we developed and did just fine. So we are at a time when there is a lot of controversy over what can be done for cognitive decline, but we're seeing improvements every day.
You'll never hear today's guest say that if you've got Alzheimer's, there's no hope. In fact, he has created a groundbreaking protocol that has allowed him to witness something that was once thought impossible. Alzheimer's patients actually recovering. And by making changes to our daily habits now, we can all take steps to protect ourselves from ever getting it. At times, any talk about degenerative brain diseases like Alzheimer's can get pretty technical. But stay tuned for information that can change your life. Stick around as we meet a man on a mission to wipe out Alzheimer's once and for all. The purpose of this podcast is to foster discussion, not to provide advice. The information shared should never be used as an alternative to obtaining personalized advice from a healthcare professional. And listeners should seek such advice independently if they have any questions related to their physical or mental health. This podcast hosts different viewpoints, and the opinions of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the views of HPE. Hello and welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life. I'm Bob Peacock. Alzheimer's disease is the seventh leading cause of death in the world today, killing more people than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. And at least here in the U.S., two-thirds of those affected with Alzheimer's are women. Alzheimer's was first identified in 1906 by German pathologist named Alois Alzheimer. He had a 50-year-old female patient who suffered from memory loss, language difficulties, and unpredictable behavior. When she died, he performed an autopsy on her brain, where he discovered clumps of a protein called beta amyloid, which form plaques, and twisted and tangled fibers of a protein called tau. For the past 115 years, doctors and scientists have focused on those two features as they search for a cure. But perhaps they were focusing on the wrong thing. Despite years of effort and hundreds of compounds, none have worked. In fact, only five to date have shown any positive results, if you call slowing the progression of the disease a positive thing. Not a single treatment, not one, has stopped Alzheimer's from even coming close to reversing its devastating effects until now. In 2014, our guest first published a groundbreaking paper and article in the journal Aging, which described his scientific findings. He had developed a revolutionary new treatment, which not only delayed the onset of Alzheimer's disease, reversing a patient's cognitive decline, but it also showed actual cognitive improvement in 9 out of 10 Alzheimer's patients within 6 months. Now that's remarkable. In 2017, he wrote a book about his findings titled The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. And as you can imagine, it quickly became an international bestseller. Since then, he has written at least 3 more books. His latest will be released in 2025, titled The Ageless Brain: How to Sharpen and Protect Your Mind for a Lifetime. Today, I'm honored to say we're talking with Dr. Dale Bredesen. Dr. Bredesen received his undergraduate degree from Caltech, the California Institute of Technology, and his medical degree from Duke University. Dr. Bredesen has held University of California faculty positions at UC Los Angeles, UC San Francisco, and UC San Diego. He has also directed the program on aging at the Burnham Institute. He's the founding president and CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. In 2013, he served as the director of the Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA. He is the senior director of Precision Brain Health at Pacific Neuroscience Institute and the chief scientific officer at Apollo Health. All this to say, he's a brilliant scientist, an experienced medical doctor, and an expert in the mechanisms of degenerative brain diseases. Dr. Bredesen, welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life.
Thanks so much, Bob. Great to be here.
Let's begin by just talking about how big the problem is. From a very high level, what is Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, the problem is huge because if you look at what happened with COVID, with the pandemic, over 1 million Americans died, for example. And if you look at Alzheimer's, it will kill over 45 million of the currently living Americans. So it actually dwarfs the pandemic. Now, in terms of what it is at a high level, this is what we spent 30 years in the laboratory. We studied the molecular basis of neurodegeneration. What are the molecules that are actually driving this? And then looking at how does this work? And as you indicated earlier, this is not just about a misfolded protein or one simple thing. A type 3 diabetes is one thing that's been commonly suggested, or a reactive oxygen species, or a herpes simplex infection of the brain. This turns out to be a network insufficiency. You have this remarkable network in your brain of about 500 trillion connections, synapses. And what's happened is quite interesting. Through evolution, we have repeatedly selected for performance over durability. And of course, the creatures that selected for durability were killed by the ones that selected for performance. So you have this remarkable synaptic network in your brain. You can store more information than over 2,000 home computers in your brain. So it's quite striking. But in selecting this sort of a neural subnetwork, and you have the same sort of thing for, you know, motor modulation and power amplification, these various subnetworks, and they're the ones that go awry in Parkinson's and ALS, things like that. So when you select for this remarkable neuroplasticity network, of course, that leaves little reserve and it leaves an Achilles heel. And so this is ultimately a network insufficiency that is affected by six different things. One being energetic support. You've got to have enough energetic support to keep it going. Inflammation. You've got too much inflammation. This starts decreasing the network size. Toxicity, various toxins we're exposed to. Trophic support, that's things like hormones, nutrients, and neurotrophins, nerve growth factor and things like that. And then neurotransmitters, you've got to have enough acetylcholine and dopamine and things like that. And then finally, and surprisingly to me, was stress. I always thought as a scientist, you know, stress is not a big deal. Well, if you resolve it quickly, it's not a big deal. But ongoing, long-term chronic stress, as we've seen for so many illnesses, also increases your risk for Alzheimer's disease. So all of these things are playing on the brain. And for many of us, they're making it so that we don't have optimal performance day to day. So that's the high-level view of what Alzheimer's has turned out to be.
Wow. So why do so many people have the disease?
Because this is essentially a system that is working at its limit for, you know, your life. And we are, to some extent, abusing it during our lives. We are getting poor sleep. We are not eating an optimal diet. Just the horrible Western diet, all the ultra processed foods, all the various toxins that we're imbibing, and all of the pro-inflammatory effects that these things have on us, all of these things alone, these things put pressure on that network. So if you think about this as a balance, we're think about it almost like a huge company. If you're in the black, okay, great, you're in good shape. And if you're in the red chronically, ultimately the company will have to downsize. And that's just what's going on in your brain. You've got these various inflammatory things. By the way, it's turning out that your oral microbiome is reflected in a brain microbiome. It used to be thought that the brain was sterile. It turns out that's not the case. There is actually a brain microbiome. And it does reflect what's in your mouth, reflects what's in your sinuses and things like that. So if you've got too much drag from things like inflammation and stress and toxicity, or too little support, and that's the other three things, that's the energetics, that's the trophic activity, and that's the neurotransmitters, then you literally cannot support those 500 trillion synapses. And your brain is actually, when it makes the compounds, you were just talking about amyloid and tau. Those are fascinating compounds, and there's no question they are related to the disease, but they are a response to your failing network. So, for example, if you get herpes simplex on your lip, it will go up your fifth nerve, your trigeminal nerve. It can end up in your brain, and you are responding to that inflammatory, that particular virus, by coating it with amyloid. Amyloid has turned out to be an antimicrobial peptide. Similarly, the tau is quite fascinating because tau normally, it basically has two different functions. So the normal function, when things are good and you are in connection mode, literally, the tau is like bolts, so that you've got, just like putting on an addition to your house, you put up the rafters, you got to bolt them down. That's what tau does. It's the bolts that stabilize the microtubules. However, when you are exposed to pathogens, to toxins, to inflammagens, things like that, and your brain literally switches over to protection mode, you now make that amyloid and you now phosphorylate your tau. So you put phosphorus oxygen on the tau, which changes its structure and changes its charge, which immediately pops it off the microtubule, allowing the microtubules to collapse. You're now pulling back, and it changes the tau function into an antimicrobial protein, which now goes around looking for and killing microbes. So you can see that you can either put your resources into building, making, and keeping new memories, or you can put it into protection. But if you're in protection mode, you can't do as much building. And this is what Alzheimer's has turned out to be.
As I said in the introduction, for the past 115 years, doctors and scientists have really been trying to solve this. You've said that our misunderstanding of Alzheimer's has hindered the efforts to treat it. And I want to talk about that for a minute. And I think it has to do a little bit with the difference between conventional medicine or 20th century medicine versus functional medicine. And as I understand it, that was key to you developing your protocol, that conventional medicine really focuses on treating symptoms, while functional medicine focuses on identifying and addressing the underlying causes of the symptoms. So can you explain what you did differently from other doctors and scientists that allowed you to make your discoveries?
Yeah, good point. So 20th century medicine was about one word: what? What is it? So is it Alzheimer's? Is it Parkinson's? Is it a broken leg? What is it? We were taught in the 20th century, and I trained, many, many years ago in the 70s and 80s, we were taught to make a diagnosis. And then you say, okay, well, what medicine? You either send someone to surgery or you write a prescription for them. And 21st century medicine is fundamentally different. The single word for 21st century medicine is why. So we're looking at why did you get this problem? Why did you get Alzheimer's? And this is a much more of a precision medicine type approach. It's much more of a network medicine or a systems biology type of approach. And this is why I always tell people, if you're getting Alzheimer's, you have to look at 36 different holes in your roof. You can close one hole, but you've got 35 others. So you've got to look at all of these things. And it can be that sleep apnea is driving this. It's usually several. We see people with 10 or 15 different contributors. You may have recurrent herpes simplex. You may have sleep apnea. You may have an insulin resistance with an ultra-processed food. You may have some excess mercury. You may have exposure to air pollution. You have to address all those. So I just got an email this morning from one of the many, many people who's done very well with this. And she's finding now that she has some exposures that are new that she wasn't aware of. She had ended up having tick-borne illnesses, very common contributor. She had Ehrlichia and Babesia. Most of us don't know that we have these various chronic conditions. We don't know. We certainly know that we're being exposed to things like the California fires. And that's another thing, unfortunately, that will do this. So this is why this is such a common problem and why, when we look at this, we have to support that network. We have to reduce the drag on it by reducing infections, toxin exposure, and things like that. And we've got to increase the supply. Vascular support, for example, oxygenation. So many people will drop their oxygenation at night and not even know about it. This is, by the way, why wearables are going to be so helpful. So finding these issues early and early detection that you're headed for this, as we now do, for example, with p-tau 217, a test that will turn positive even before you get Alzheimer's. So you can look to see, just like a hemoglobin A1C, looking to see if you've got pre-diabetes before diabetes, you can look to see if you have pre-Alzheimer's now for the first time. And it's really fantastic. So it's going to change the likelihood of people developing Alzheimer's disease. So the idea in terms of why we did things differently, we were looking at signaling of APP, which is the parent for the amyloid. And this has a very interesting switching phenomenon. When things are good, you cut this molecule at a single site, and you develop two peptides called SAPP-alpha and alpha-CTF, C-terminal fragment. And those were both things that actually support and maintain synapses. On the other hand, when things are bad, you've got inflammation or not enough hormonal support or not enough oxygenation, so forth and so on, this same molecule gets cut at three sites and now produces four peptides, and one of them is the amyloid beta peptide that ends up in the plaques that you mentioned and that Dr. Alzheimer saw way back in 1906. And by the way, Dr. Oscar Fischer also at the same time saw, so probably should have been named Alzheimer Fischer disease. Mm. But in any case, these things then are being produced. And so we wanted to know what is driving you one way or another. So we actually screened for drugs back in the early 2000s that would switch you from one side to the other. And we actually identified some. But we realized, okay, the drug can do that, but it's doing it unnaturally. What about all the things that are now pushing this, forcing this back to the wrong, to the bad side of things? And so we wanted to know, okay, what are all those things? And we identified initially, as you mentioned, we identified 36 different things. And so we were very interested in how does this all work together? Why did your brain set this up this way? What is this pathophysiology? And so the big change here is in going from pathology, saying, oh, look at the amyloid, look at the tau, let's get rid of that stuff, not knowing what it does, to physiology. These things are there for a reason. Your brain is not trying to give itself Alzheimer's. Your brain is trying to fight various infections, toxins, so forth and so on. So we have to, whatever the treatment's going to be, it has to address what those things are.
And in your first book, you said that instead of looking for that single silver bullet, you were looking for silver buckshot, right?
Exactly. So we want to look at these various things because, you know, let's be fair, the brain is a very complicated organ. And so you have to look at what is the actual physiology that's going on here? What is it fighting? You know, you look inside those plaques, guess what's in there? Pathogens. You look inside there and you see bacteria, you see fungi, you see viruses. So it's a little bit like, imagine that you had a town. And imagine that into your town came, you know, one robber. Well, you don't want to shut down your entire town and say, nobody go to work, everybody stay home, we're going to try to catch this guy. If you simply take this thing and you incarcerate this person quickly, you don't shut down the town. So what's happened is we have a mechanism in our brains when we have very modest things like very few viral particles, very little in terms of bacterial infection, very little in terms of fungal infection, that we have essentially what is a pre-inflammatory component. We can surround these things and kill them with amyloid. Now, if things get out of hand, no question about it, if you've got a lot of infection, you're going to do much more. You are going to shut things down, but you're going to have trouble thinking and things like that. What's amazing is you can walk around with this amyloid in your brain for 20 years or more because you don't trigger this dramatic inflammation early on, as long as what's affecting you is not too severe. In fact, there are some nice studies done with herpes showing that you get an Alzheimer-type response when you have a very low herpetic infection of about one viral particle per 10,000 cells. So these are these very modest things that we encounter throughout life. As you can imagine, is you just keep on getting exposed, ultimately things start to break down. You don't have enough with just a little bit of amyloid. So now you do call in the troops, you do bring the inflammation, and unfortunately that does compromise the cognitive function. So if you understand the disease that way and you help the brain to reduce that inflammation, reduce that drag, and increase that support, identifying all the various things, which typically, you know, isn't being done at various clinics, then in fact, you really get much, much better outcomes. And we've published, you know, the best outcomes in the world.
Well, I want to be careful not to overstate or understate the importance and impact of your findings. The first scientifically proven treatment that actually enhances cognition of Alzheimer's patients and even reverses the decline of their brain function is absolutely revolutionary. It's groundbreaking. But when you first wrote your paper, it was met with some controversy. And I'm sure listeners are thinking, it sounds too good to be true. Why aren't we reading about your findings on the front page of every newspaper in the world? Why has it taken the medical community so long to support those new ideas?
Yeah, this is such a good point. You know, we're in the middle of this right now with a New York Times reporter who's doing a story, but it was trying to couch this in, oh, this is still controversial. So here's the thing. Medicine is the opposite of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is, and certainly the tech world has been all about taking that next step and always being on the cutting edge. Medicine has always been about tradition and permission, which is important because it protects patients from trying, you know, wacky new things that may not help. On the other hand, it means that the advances come slowly. And you can look at some amazing historical comparisons. If you look at scurvy killed many, many people. And there was an understanding in terms of what you could do about it in the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s, and the 1900s. And each time the experts said, no, that's not right. And so, you know, more thousands and thousands of people died of scurvy. Finally, in the 1900s, it was figured out, oh, this is about vitamin C. And of course, now there's very little scurvy. If you look at childhood leukemia in the late 1940s, there was nothing to do about childhood leukemia. A pathologist at Harvard said, it looks like when people are treated for anemia, they seem to get worse, not better. And I'm wondering if folate might be something that is being used by these leukemic cells. So he gave an anti-folate treatment, kind of counterintuitive, and killed a couple of the children, but it got the first glimmer of improvement in a few. And that is why today the majority of children with childhood leukemia live and do just fine. We're doing the same thing, which is basically compassionate use. So we started with the first 10 that you mentioned. Then we published another 10. Then we published 100. Then we published a proof of concept trial that was published and freely available online, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's in 2022. Then an independent group published the same approach and got the same results. That was in 2023. Now we're in the middle of a randomized controlled trial. So the naysayers have said, well, we don't believe it yet. We want you to show us more people. My counter argument has been, yes, but the compassionate use dictates that if you have something that shows anecdotal success in a situation where there is nothing else, then you shouldn't wait for thousands and thousands of people, because people are dying. People are in need. And so, and I was just, before we started this, I happened to run across a letter that I got way back in 2016, some of our first patients, written by a woman whose father had died of Alzheimer's, her grandmother had died of Alzheimer's, and she had just been diagnosed with the earliest changes in her case. And she was very young. She was in her late 40s, and she was horrified. And she thought, you know, what am I going to do here? She had gone to a major university medical center where they told her, yeah, you're in the earliest throes of this, and there's nothing really to do. She's done very well, by the way. This is now, you know, 9 years later. She's done great, and she's now no longer worried about her children. And so how do you withhold that from people? How do you say, look, there, you know, there's something that's working again and again and again, but you know, we want thousands more people, so please go home and die. I find that difficult, but I understand the idea that there is skepticism, where we're saying something that hasn't been said before. That yes, there's a lot you can do about this. Now, we've never said this is a cure, because we see people improve. And by the way, we just published another freely available online paper that shows sustained improvements for over a decade in some people. However, in our clinical trial, 84% of people showed improvement, not 100%. Some people declined. And we're very interested in what is the difference between the ones who improve the most and the ones who continue their decline. And we do see the same sort of patterns again and again. So you're absolutely right. There has been pushback. There continues to be pushback. And so this approach is not being taken by the major university medical centers. And in fact, I've had a couple of calls from people who were told nothing could be done at various university centers of excellence, and then went on the protocol we developed and did just fine. So we are at a time when there is a lot of controversy over what can be done for cognitive decline, but we're seeing improvements every day.
So in 2017, you wrote your first book. People started reaching out to you, probably from all over the world. How many people have gone through the RECODE protocol now, and what kind of success have you seen? Can you talk about some of the patients and their successes?
Absolutely. So here's the thing. So there have been over 10,000 people now, and there are a lot of people. We started training physicians. We've now trained over 2,000 physicians in 10 different countries and all over the United States as well. And some of them are getting very good results, and some of them are not. And so that's been one concern. It's very much like learning a new surgical procedure. It's not a simple prescription pad medicine where you're just going to, you know, get a drug and it's going to be the same every time. You have to dig. You have to do the identification of all the things that are driving the decline, and then you have to address those and continue to optimize this. Now, I look forward to the day when it's much simpler. But currently, we know that we can understand the process much better, and we can get good results. And I'll give you an example. Sally, who's actually in who's in the doc. There's a film documentary about all of this, which is on Amazon Prime, which is called Memories for Life, Reversing Alzheimer's. And it's narrated by Michael Bublé, who did a great job. And so Sally was one who was a professor of nursing, actually, and developed this in her late 50s and early 60s. And again, you know, we used to, when I was training, we never saw people in their 40s and 50s with Alzheimer's. It's one of the most common things we see now, very, very common. And the epidemiologists have shown that to be the case, that the biggest increases are in people in their 40s and 50s. So it's no longer old timers disease. You know, it really is a disease that we get in our 20s, 30s, and 40s that's diagnosed 20 years later. So she started out, she had an amyloid positive scan. So she definitely had Alzheimer's. She is ApoE4 positive. So in other words, the most common genetic risk is ApoE4. And I should just stop for a moment there and say 3/4 of the population is negative for ApoE4, but it is very common. So 3/4 are negative. For example, I check my own, I'm an ApoE3/3. That's the most common. So that means your risk of Alzheimer's for your lifetime is about 9%. Not zero, but it's not too high. If you have a single copy, and that's 75 million Americans, including Sally, your chance during your lifetime is 30%. And if you have two copies, and that's 7 million Americans, most of whom don't know it, your chance is about 90%. Most likely you will develop Alzheimer's during your lifetime. And this is why we encourage everyone, please, for everyone who's over 35, get evaluated, get what we call a, quote, brain scan. It's just a simple blood test that you check your p-tau, your GFAP, and your NFL, neurofilament light. So you can see this coming literally and prevent it from happening. So Sally then went on a drug trial. It actually made her worse, not better. And so she quit it after 8 administrations of the treatment. Her MoCA score was 24 out of 30, which is significant MCI, mild cognitive impairment. So she had mild cognitive impairment due to the Alzheimer's disease underlying pathology that was shown by her amyloid positive scan. She went on our protocol. She's now 7 years with improvement. So she went back to a perfect 30. Her hippocampal volume went from the 14th percentile to the 28th percentile. So we look at volumetrics on MRIs to get an idea about whether there's atrophy. She turned out to have multiple factors that contributed. We addressed those. Now, interestingly, after 6 years, she started having problems again. And so she was reevaluated, and no surprise, she had new factors contributing, 3 of them. She actually had new and very severe sleep apnea. She had a Cryptococcus laurentii infection in her sinuses, which hadn't been picked up before. And she had a new exposure to some specific biotoxins. These were addressed, and she went right back to doing very well once again. So again, you can see the dynamic nature of this neural network of synapses within your brain. And you can see that it's not as simple as, you know, some protein randomly misfolded. This is a very complex network that is being played upon by all of these different things that we encounter. As human beings, we encounter toxins and we encounter various organisms and things like that through so many sources. You know, I'm concerned about, you know, the California fires, because it's going to increase the risk for cognitive decline. We already know that COVID-19 increases risk for cognitive decline. And one of the most common presentations we now hear about is for someone who was doing fairly well and then got COVID-19 and started going downhill after that.
Yes.
So she's one great example of someone who has done very, very well.
So am I right in saying that the key to ending Alzheimer's from your perspective and stopping its growth all over the world is prevention? You've said that virtually no one should ever have to die from Alzheimer's.
Exactly. So the trick is here that this is a chronic illness that occurs in 4 stages. And if we could just get people to come in the first 2 stages instead of the last 2 stages, which is the current standard, they come in when they have MCI or dementia. So you go through the four stages. Number one stage is you're pre-symptomatic. And that's where you can pick it up in a blood test and say, aha, you're on your way to getting this. So thank goodness you checked. The second stage is called SCI, subjective cognitive impairment. That's where you know, something's not quite right here. But you're still able to score normally on standard cognitive tests. And so the doctor typically tells you, look, you know, you're scoring fine. You know, don't worry. Go home. You're probably going to be okay. Yeah, they say that because they have nothing to offer. But you really, those are the two phases where you want to know, either by a blood test or when you have absolutely the beginning symptoms. We're told, oh, it's just normal aging. Oh, you know, everybody forgets their keys. Everybody, you know, has a time when they can't find their car in a parking lot. No, you know, listen to those things. They're telling you your neural subnetwork is not being supported in the way it was being supported. And that's the time to get treated. Those people, 100% of those people get better. When you identify the things, address them, it's easy. The problem is people wait to that third stage MCI, where, as I mentioned, we get 84% of the people with MCI and early dementia. By definition, MCI means you're now not scoring normally on cognitive tests, but you're still able to care for yourself, activities of daily living. You can drive, you can balance your checkbook, stuff like that. Dementia is the fourth and final phase. And as it gets into dementia, it's harder and harder to reverse things significantly. We do have people with MoCA scores of zero. These are Montreal Cognitive Assessments, so they're very, very far along, who get some improvement, but they don't get all the way back to normal. So this is why we want to get things early. And this is why I believe that these new blood tests, along with things like wearables, are going to reduce the global burden of dementia, because we can now see this coming. But this old-fashioned idea of just put your head in the sand because it's probably not Alzheimer's, well, that was just because they had nothing to offer Alzheimer's. There's so much now that we can all do, not only to avoid Alzheimer's, but to stay sharper each and every day. This is why we talk about performance and protection. And that's what the new book's about, getting the combination of performance and protection for everybody.
In your first book, you also suggest that everyone age 40 and over get a cognoscopy.
Yeah, great point. So, and that was, by the way, as you mentioned, 2017, that was before these new blood tests became available. So now we have two pieces of this. The cognoscopy was basically you get some basic blood labs, you get a simple online cognitive assessment, and then if you're symptomatic, you want to get an MRI. Those are all part now of the second piece. The first piece is, what is my status? In other words, it's about if. Do I have something that's concerning or not? And that's the one that I mentioned that has the p-tau217, the GFAP, and the NFL. And that's what we call brain scan. You can get it. You can literally get it online. Get a brain scan. I had mine drawn at my house. Everybody should know their blood pressure. Everybody should know their lipid profile. Everybody should know their fasting glucose. And everybody should know their p-tau217. And again, easy to get now, easy to check. You want to know that you're not having problems. And, you know, if it's normal, fine. You can just recheck it every 5 years. So easy to do. The second piece then is, if there are any issues, you want to know why. What are my risks? What is driving this problem? And that's what so we call these RECODE labs, but it's labs that you can get. And again, you can get this via online in a local blood draw, very simple, so that you don't even have to have your doctor order these. It's very simple now. And again, we should all know these sorts of things. This will tell you things like your HOMA-IR, which is, do you have insulin resistance? Your homocysteine, do you have methylation problems that are associated with cognitive decline? Do you have various toxin exposures? You know, is your mercury high? Do you have a genetic predisposition? Do you have APOE4? As an example, this gives you dozens and dozens of things that will begin to tell you now, how is your network? What are the things that are putting pressure on that? What are the things that are indicating you don't have enough supply? So again, if everybody knew this, there would have to be very, very little true dementia.
Is it especially important for people who played football or any other sport where you might have had a history of head trauma?
Yeah, you brought up a really good point. Who are the people for which this is especially important? And they are, number one, anybody with dementia in the family, because there are genetics associated with this. Now, to be fair, 95% is sporadic. But you have an increased risk, just like if you have increased risk if you have a poor lipid profile for cardiac disease. So anyone with any dementia in the family, especially concerned. Secondly, anyone who's had some brain fog or had issues like that. Thirdly, of course, COVID. So for people who've had COVID, especially if you've had multiple bouts or if you've had brain fog with your COVID or if you have long COVID, that's really, really important. And as you mentioned, anyone with a history of head trauma, that increases risk, whether it's because you played football, whether it's because you had a traffic accident, a common problem, whether because you did a lot of heading of the ball in soccer, or you got hit in the head with spiked volleyballs or baseballs, any of these sorts of things, head trauma, definitely you're at increased risk. You want to make sure to look into this. So there are a lot of these risk factors. If you have prediabetes, that's another one, very important to get checked. So if you've got hypertension, another risk factor. So those people should be especially wary and get in there and check when you're still young, 35 or 40.
Good. There's a free online assessment that I want to mention that anybody can take to assess their cognitive quotient, which might point to some signs of early Alzheimer's. It takes about 15 minutes. What will the assessment tell me and how does it work?
Yes, go to MyCQ test. That's a simple way to do it. Just MyCQTEST. And this is a very rapid way to find out where you stand, whether you're having any symptoms. It's very much complementary to blood tests. And it'll tell you, are things not going quite as well as they should be going? And as we get past 35 or 40, this may weigh on us more than before. So this will look at some things like your processing speed, your memory, your executive function, your other kind of cognitive parameters, visual perception and memory, verbal memory. All of these things are tested fairly quickly in this CQ test. So it really does give you a good idea. And I know a lot of people have said, wow, I didn't realize I was starting to have some faltering in these areas. And, I do want to get on this now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the RECODE protocol itself. Describe what someone goes through when someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's and he or she comes to you to follow your protocol.
The idea here, again, we want to catch them as early as possible and look at, okay, what are the things that are driving this? So we take the labs and, when I first started doing this on my own, which was back in 2012, I saw the very first patient that turned around April of 2012. And it would take me about 2.5 hours for each person to go through all the different parameters and then construct from that what are the main drivers of the decline, and then from that, what is an optimal program for this person to improve. Now, of course, we do it, and I worked with Apollo Health. I'm a consultant to Apollo Health, and Lance Kelly and a fantastic team, which came originally from Apple, has done a great job with putting together the RECODE algorithm and protocol. So now what used to take me 2.5 hours takes them a few microseconds, and you now have a nice report that shows, okay, here are the things. So if you break this down and look at, what is it? What does it take to reverse this synaptic loss? It's 7 basics and 2 specifics. That simple. So that you're looking at all of the molecular detail that makes this synaptic network supported or pulled back. So you're now trying to get rid of the things that are causing it to pull back and increase the things that are supporting it. And here's what that takes. And again, it's going to be different for each person. This is a personalized protocol. This is why we call it, it's a precision medicine by definition approach, because you're directing the treatment against the things that cause the problem. So you start with some basics that everybody can do, and that is diet. Interestingly, you know, again, as a scientist and a neurologist, I used to think diet was virtually meaningless. I was totally wrong. It turns out that it's very important. And a plant-rich, mildly ketogenic diet is the thing that has been associated with greatest improvement in cognition, repeatedly and published repeatedly. Exercise, and it turns out there's all sorts of things that exercise actually helps with, both on the aerobic side and on the strength training side, and they're complementary. Strength training gives you better insulin sensitivity, for example, whereas the aerobic gives you better blood flow and oxygenation and things like that. So they're very much complementary, these two. And there are some new and interesting things like EWOT, exercise with oxygen therapy, that actually can be very powerful in helping people. Katsu bands are another thing. So the exercise is a critical piece. Sleep turns out to be, again, something that has turned out to be very important. You want to get at least an hour of deep sleep each night, at least an hour and a half of REM sleep each night, and a total sleep of at least 7 hours at night with an oxygen saturation of at least 94% each night. And when people begin to check, they often find out that theirs has dropped much lower than that, even into the 80s, even into the 70s. So it's a really good idea to check on your sleep as well. And then the fifth one is brain training. Professor Mike Mersnick won the Kavli Prize, which is essentially the neuroscience Nobel Prize, for being the father of brain training. And he's shown what actually works to improve your cognitive parameters. Then the sixth one is detoxification. For so many of us, we don't know we're carrying around a big load of these various toxins. And the toxins come in three different types. They are the inorganics, things like air pollution, mercury, things like that. The organics, things like anesthetic agents, and toluene, benzene, formaldehyde, glyphosate, all those things are organics that can contribute. And they are, you basically, essentially, as they say, get your tub full. Your body is trying to excrete these things, metabolize them, and it stores them in your brain and in various organs. And then the third group is the biotoxins. And this is surprising because it still is claimed by many standard of care physicians that biotoxins have nothing to do with cognitive decline, but we see it every day. It's one of the most common contributors to cognitive decline. And these are things like mycotoxins produced by specific molds like Stachybotrys and Penicillium aspergillus, Ketomium wallemia. These are all mold species that produce neurotoxins. And so, you know, they're trying to survive. What they're really trying to do, these molds, is to kill the bacteria around them that otherwise would crowd them out. The bacteria grow faster. That's their approach. The molds are like, okay, but we're going to make penicillin. So that's how they started making these antibacterial things. Unfortunately, some of them are neurotoxins for humans. So detox is the sixth thing, and then the seventh of the basic seven things. As just some targeted supplements, you can resolve some inflammation with things discovered at Harvard called Resolvins. They actually work quite well. These were discovered by Professor Charles Sirhan. There are, for people who are low in vitamin D, most of us are too high in our omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. So we're living in a chronic pro-inflammatory state. So all of those are the seven basics, and you can optimize those things and keep optimizing. They do very well. For many people, that's great. That's enough. But then you want to look at specifics, and you want to look at, are there ongoing chronic infections? For example, is your oral microbiome abnormal? Do you have a lot of P. gingivalis, which is associated with periodontitis and also associated strongly with Alzheimer's disease? Do you have T. denticola? So, you know, finding out your oral microbiome and then addressing these specific things. You know, do you have recurrent outbreaks of herpes? Very interesting study out of Taiwan showing that people who actually treated their outbreaks of herpes reduced their dementia risk by over 50%. So it's really striking results that they got. And then In addition to these pathogens, you want to look at the seventh one, or the second of the specifics, which is various toxins that I mentioned earlier. And you want to find out which ones are you exposed to. And then you want to do a detox. And that's the hardest part of all this. If you're awash in toxins for, you know, your whole life of exposure, it's going to take a little while to slowly wash these things out. But people have had very good results when they're able to reduce these things. So if you take those seven basics and the two specifics, you are really addressing the actual causes of this and supporting synaptogenesis.
And how important is it that you follow every piece of these, all seven of them, in order to see results? Are there some that are more important than others, some less important?
Yeah, it's a great point. So, you know, we always tell people, if you can do the majority of them, then you probably don't need to do everything. Now, what we don't know yet, we can't, there's no simple measure for how much are you going to have to do to get better. So you just have to follow. This is why, as I say, people who just continue to work typically with the health coach and a physician continue to tweak and optimize things, do the best. So for some people, they just start the basics and like, wow, things are much better. Whereas you're right, others, especially the ones that have these heavy toxic burdens and have had symptoms for many years, you really do have to do more and you have to do it for a longer time. You know, no big surprise. This is no different than what you'd have with metastatic cancer. You know, if you get in early before you have metastatic cancer, it's pretty easy. You can typically do surgery and do very well with cancer. If you wait until there are metastases all over, then unfortunately it's much harder. And the same thing goes for cognitive decline. So for some people, yes, you're absolutely right. You can do some basics and really have a big impact.
I want to give you a chance to talk about your latest book, The Ageless Brain, How to Sharpen and Protect Your Mind for a Lifetime.
Yeah, thank you so much. So a lot of people said, look, you know, there's been a lot about Alzheimer's disease, but what about for everybody? You know, how do we optimize our performance and protection for a lifetime? What can we do? There's, as you know, there's so much interest now in anti-aging. And so I was talking to various YPO groups and saying, okay, you know, who wants to live to 140? And, you know, all these hands would shoot up, and I would say, and spend half of that time in a nursing home with dementia.
Right.
Of course, the hands would all go back down. And so the point of this book is, how do we make it so that we can assure for all of us that our brain span is as long as our lifespan, whether you live to 80, 90, 100, or more than 100, how do we make sure that everybody stays sharp and has good performance and protection? And then I give a couple of examples there for people who, you know, caught, you know, early changes where, you know, we, although it might be Parkinson's or Alzheimer's down the road, early on, you know, you're just living your normal life and you're not realizing that something's not quite right here. So again, getting back to early detection, wearables, and performance, and then jumping on these things early and optimizing these networks, because you've got these beautiful neural subnetworks that are just so remarkable. The one that's motor modulation, which, you know, take a look at Simone Biles, you can see what humans can do with motor modulation. That's the one that fails in Parkinson's disease. And you can see why. That Achilles heel for that network happens to be mitochondrial complex 1, a specific protein. But there are, again, many ways to get there with various toxins and things. And then the power amplification is remarkable. You have the ability to go from what it takes energetically to have a single thought, which is somewhere around a millionth of a calorie per second, to what it takes to do maximal muscular contraction, which is around a half a calorie per second. So you have more than what you get by stomping on your accelerator in your car. That's the sort of dramatic amplification human beings can do. But as you can imagine, that neural subnetwork also has its own Achilles heel. And so you've got to take care of that. You've got to look ahead. And because if you don't, you end up getting ALS. So this book is all about how do we, for all of us, optimize our performance and protection for our entire lifetimes.
Well, you have dedicated your life to ending Alzheimer's. What is the hardest part of making sure fewer and fewer people die from Alzheimer's? You've discovered your protocol. You know it works. What do you want people all around the world to know?
Yeah, great point. So there are two issues here. One is how to continue to simplify it. We're trying to make it as simple as possible without making it so simple that it doesn't work. I mean, that is the problem. Everybody wants a quick fix. And so there's no single medicine yet. I hope someday there will be one, but so far there isn't. And so you really do have to identify the things and you really do have to address them. And then the second piece is I'm hoping that with these various trials, ultimately, the pushback will subside. What's happened so far is that the various mainstream figures have said, don't do this, don't try this because we don't believe it yet. And unfortunately, a lot of people have not been treated, have not sought treatment. I've had a number of people contact me and say, I'm having problems. I say, okay, here's what you need to do. And then they say, oh, wait a minute, I talked to the head at this place or that place, and they said, don't do it. So they end up doing nothing and dying, which is very, very sad to me. So I think that we're in a period where there is upheaval. We are changing. Things are changing. And so I hope that we'll get to a point where there won't be so much pushback that will prevent people from doing the right things. Because you do have to continue. You've got to have some belief to continue with this, continue to get evaluated and treated. As I say, I mean, my greatest pleasure is getting various emails and notes from people who've done really well, and to talk to physicians and health coaches and practitioners who are getting great outcomes. One of the practitioners early on said, when I treated the first patient and the first patient got better and came back to the office, I started crying. The doctor started crying in front of the patient because she had never seen that before. I mean, that's, once you see that, you really realize, oh, wait a minute, there's something important here. We really need to focus on this. And let's face it, continue to optimize it. There are going to be better and better outcomes as time goes along. So those are the two things that I hope will really make it so that we can all reduce the global burden of dementia and ultimately reduce the global burden of all neurodegenerative diseases.
Well, discovering a protocol that could potentially end Alzheimer's disease is nothing short of extraordinary. And it's hard to fully convey the immense impact that your research, your work will have on countless lives. So thank you for making such a monumental contribution to science and humanity. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks very much. And thanks so much to HPE for getting the word out for new things all over the world. So thanks so much, Bob. Great to talk to you.
We've talked a lot on this podcast about the importance of taking control of your own healthcare, making good health decisions a priority, and being dedicated to ensuring you're the healthiest and happiest you can be, protecting your body and your mind. So, a question. What now? Now that you know how to live a longer, healthier life without the complications of Alzheimer's, what will you do with that information? If we do nothing, Alzheimer's will continue to be a major health threat. Doing whatever we can to prevent it from continuing to grow around the world is something we can all choose to do for ourselves, for our families, our kids, even our grandkids. I mentioned the free online cognitive assessment that can help you know if you have early signs of Alzheimer's. Again, it's available at mycqtest.com. You can also go to that web address to learn a whole lot more about Dr. Bredesen's protocols and to subscribe to emails for the latest research news, science results, and more. You might want to check out Dr. Dale E. Bredesen's books, too. His latest book is The Ageless Brain, How to Sharpen and Protect Your Mind for a Lifetime. So many great resources to learn more. And just a reminder for HPE team members, there are many resources to help you live a longer, healthier, and happier life available to you and your family members in the HPE Global Wellness Program. If you're in the U.S., you'll find those on myhperewards.com. And if you're outside the U.S., you'll find them on the Global Wellness page. My thanks to Dr. Dale Bredesen for his time today and for everything he's doing to end Alzheimer's once and for all. And as always, thank you so much for listening. That's all for this episode. Until next time, please take good care of yourself. Let's talk again soon.